Let's welcome our panelists. Obviously, Joe and Steve have seen the film before. And I know that Mr. Bassett has seen the film because we were together at the screening at South by Southwest where the film premiered, but Governor White and Mr. Jacobson have not seen it. So I'm going to ask them first. First, Governor White, and then Mr. Jacobson. Your reaction to what you saw. Obviously, you're a player, minor player in this film, but you're more familiar with the facts of the case than the average person. What do you think about what you saw up on that screen?
I concur with my wife. I need to lose weight.
Well, you're not running again, so it's not an immediate problem. What a...
Who knows?
Yeah.
Jerry Brown gave inspiration.
Well, all right.
No, I thought the film was very good. I thought it was fair, and I thought it was, it pointed out very clearly the fragility of our criminal justice system. It's something that's more fragile than the average citizen will ever know. And I think they did a good job of presenting it. I thought it was fair. I thought they gave expression to all sides. They let the widow speak. They let everybody speak. And I thought it was a good and fair representation.
Your point of view about the outcome of the Willingham case changed at all by this film?
I didn't hear you.
Is your point of view about the outcome of this case changed at all by this film? Is it strength of the position that you took up on screen and representing the family? You obviously have a point of view about the case. Is that affected in any way by this film?
No, I still feel the same way. I think there was no evidence of a scientific evidence of his crime being committed, of arson, and in the absence of any evidence of arson, there's no ability for the state to execute a person or have that person be found guilty.
Mr. Jacobson, let me ask you the same thing. What's your reaction to this film?
I liked it. I really did. I thought the ending of the film actually captures the paradox that seems to exist at the heart of what's going on here. You have this scientific evidence that clearly has changed in 20 years. I don't think there's any question about that. And the city of Corsicana never took the position otherwise. I think there have been many changes. But there still exists some nagging doubts and some other evidence that suggests he actually did it, confessing, for example, to Johnny Webb, who probably isn't very credible, but also confessing to his wife. And I think that is somewhat credible. She's not on Oprah. She's not trying to get a book deal. She gets up and speaks her heart. In Corsicana, she stays out of the limelight. I wouldn't, nor if I saw her. So I think that the film actually sort of grapples with and captures the public debate. Innocent, guilty, science better, science worse. Forensic Science Commission, jurisdiction, no jurisdiction. And unfortunately, there's no resolution because there is no resolution.
You have a point of view specifically about whether the Forensic Science Commission had, in this case, jurisdiction to reopen and reexamine what we just saw up on screen.
Yeah, and we've asked the Attorney General for an opinion on that. I think there is no question legally that the Forensic Science Commission does not have the legal jurisdiction to investigate Willingham. The statute, when it was passed, only applied to evidence that was actually offered into evidence or tested on or after September 1 of 2005. Willingham was put to death in 2004. And I think 100 times out of 100 in front of a fair judge, we win the argument. That doesn't mean that they weren't still trying to do the work that they were trying to do. And it doesn't mean that the work's not important. Actually, I think the report that's been produced is helpful. It's beneficial. And the city of Corsicana cooperated with 100% the Forensic Science Commission in providing information, documents, access to witnesses, things like that. But I don't think they have the jurisdiction to do what they're doing, period.
I want to ask our other panelists about that. Let me just ask you two more quick things.
You sure.
Do not dispute the question of whether the science at the time is insufficient to the task of investigating a case like this versus the science now?
I'm not a criminal lawyer. I practice civil trial law. And so my acquaintance with forensic science, specifically arson science, has been all in the last 2 years. But I've acquired somewhat of a working knowledge of it, and I think I can tell you what I think about it. I think that the time that the trial occurred, the people testified similarly to what other people testified to in other places and other times, or at the same time, excuse me. Since that point in time, though, clearly, the science has changed. And I don't think that you can really, in good faith, dispute that.
Yeah. Last thing is, Governor White said, no arson, no case. You believe that this was an arson fire?
Again, I'm not a criminal defense lawyer. I've talked to a few prosecutors and a few criminal defense attorneys, and here's kind of the sense I get from it. Had there been a last-second reprieve, had Todd Willingham been given a new trial, what you would have would be a fire scene that's consistent with flashover and consistent with arson. I don't think any of the experts ever said that the fire scene is not consistent with arson. You have accelerant inside the house, you have two confessions, And since, the, I guess, the case has been tried, the film didn't mention this. I'm not even sure y'all even knew about it, Joe, but there was a guy who came forward who claims to have seen Todd Willingham removing belongings from his house and putting them in his car while the fire was ongoing. So what you would have would be a fight over the science of it. Is this caused by flashover? Is it caused by an accelerant? You would have testimony from people who claim they heard a confession from Willingham. You would attack their credibility. Then you have this new witness. What would happen would happen. Right. Could he be convicted again? Sure, he could be.
Mr. Bassett, let me ask you to address Mr. Jacobson's point about whether the commission, which you led for almost 4 years, actually even has a role in this conversation going forward. He believes that the commission is in error in reconsidering the case. What do you think?
I thought, and so did the prosecutor sitting with me on the commission, Alan Levy, thought we were the two lawyers on the commission. And Alan Levy was, for many of you who know, was the head of the trial division of the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office for many years. He's since retired. No prosecutor that I know of has prosecuted more death penalty cases than Alan. And Alan and I worked well together on the commission, and we looked at the jurisdiction question, and we felt comfortable that the statute provided jurisdiction to look into cases before 2005. I know that it's an open question. Mr. Bradley and others have asked for an opinion at the Attorney General's office, but there was never a question in our mind whether or not we had jurisdiction. And when this came up, if you recall, in February 2009, I was called into the governor's office, not by the governor, but by two of his aides, and they questioned the jurisdiction as well. So I stopped in my tracks, and I thought, well, maybe we're wrong on this. So I went to Senator Whitmire's office, one of the authors of the bill. I said, Senator Whitmire, do we have jurisdiction? I didn't talk to him directly, but I talked to his chief criminal justice advisor, and his word to me was the senator thinks the commission is doing exactly what the statute was created to do. So I was satisfied both in my legal analysis and in a practical question to the author of the bill that we had jurisdiction.
Terry and then Joe.
Yeah, and Sam, I think this issue was raised, at least by me, after you were already off the commission. But the problem is that most Texas lawyers, when you look at a statute, you go to the statute and Vernon statutes and read it or get off Westlaw. The enabling legislation that created the Forensic Science Commission is found in, I believe it's House Bill 1068 from the legislature. If you go back and read that bill, it just says, the commission is authorized to investigate evidence that's tested or offered into evidence on or after September 1, 2005. It makes two exceptions to that. Number one is if somebody's in jail, the Forensic Science Commission can go back and still look at whether the evidence that put that person in jail was good evidence or not. The other exception is if a person's been charged with a crime but has not yet been adjudicated, the Forensic Science Commission can weigh in there as well. Otherwise, the Forensic Science Commission could go back and ask the question whether Lee Harvey Oswald really fired the shots in Dallas in November of 63. The problem is the authorization that the legislature gave the Forensic Science Commission isn't found in Black's Texas statutes, but it is in the bill as filed and as approved online. I can give you the reference to it and take you to it. I have a copy downstairs. So I'm not sure that either Mr. Levy or Mr. Bassett was even aware of that, but it is there, and if you look at it, that's exactly what it says.
Mr. Bailey's been patient trying to get into this.
Well, I was going to ask, would the Texas Attorney General, there was an Attorney General on the commission for the time that you were there advising the panel?
Yes. Barbara Dean of the Texas Attorney General's office was essentially the lawyer, serving as general counsel for the commission from the start of the time that we started meeting and discussing not just this investigation, but other matters.
And she never brought up the issue of jurisdiction at all to you guys?
No.
Joe and Steve, let me ask you about a question about the intent of this film. You know, you have both said publicly, and others have said about this film, this is not a film about the death penalty. This is a film about forensic science. It is very difficult, I would say maybe impossible, to walk away from watching this film not thinking that you are advocating for the innocence of Cameron Willingham in this case. Do you dispute that?
I think that we feel there's not evidence. There's definitely reasonable doubt that he didn't do it. And so we can't really say that he did it or not, but we're not convinced that he did.
It is the purpose of this film to exonerate Willingham, or is it to identify what might be flawed about the forensic science used to convict him?
I think when we came to the film, we didn't really look at it for having a purpose so much as that we saw all of these issues that we're talking about here being animated in a way that was really vibrant and contemporary. And, you know, you had mystery elements, and you had forensic science and criminal justice and all of these things alive in a way that we had never seen before. And so we thought that was really fascinating. We thought it was fascinating that the juxtaposition you were talking about, where you have people that are very convicted of his guilt, and then you have scientists who are very convicted that there's no evidence.
It's very human. It's very human.
Yes. Oh, no, absolutely. And so we thought it was, we came at it from a more universal place, I think. But as far as where I stand personally on the matter, when I started making the film, I didn't really have any strong convictions about the death penalty for or against. And I still think that conceivably it could be sustainable if we could have absolute confidence. But I don't think we can, is the problem.
Mr. Bassett and then Governor White, I want to ask you about the politics of this, because obviously this is a film about science, but at its heart, it's also a film about the very particular politics in this case. I mean, you can't separate the politics of the Willingham case from the science of the Willingham case. And Governor Perry is, well, he takes it on the chin a little bit in this film. Mr. Bassett, I've never heard you address publicly what you believed happened when the time came for you not to be reappointed by the governor. We know what others have said, but I'd like to ask you to address for this audience and for all of us, what do you think happened with regard to your the governor declining to reappoint you at that moment?
I've never been a politician, and I don't think I ever will be. But it's hard for me to speculate exactly what was going on in the governor's office when I was called over there and asked to reconsider this investigation, other than I speculate that the governor may not have even known about them putting pressure on me initially. I think he learned about it fairly quickly. But I was always concerned that the mission of the Forensic Science Commission in emphasizing the improvement of forensic science in the courtrooms would get lost in the political shuffle. And I'm evading your question, Evan, by saying, I don't know. I don't know. I can guess as to motivations. I can guess that nobody in elected office wants to say I was on watch when somebody innocent was executed. The fact of the matter is we will never know if Mr. Willingham was innocent. I just was surprised, as I said in the film, by the way, Steve is the one that made me cry. The question that caused me to ball up was take off your hat as a forensic scientist, just tell me as a human being how you feel about this. And I was, oh man, so that happened. But I will say that what got lost in the debate about innocence or guilt or death penalty was the approach that stunned me from people from all sides of the aisle was they were so worried about looking bad that they forgot about the search for what could improve the system for the future. And that's what bothered me the most about it.
I appreciate your attempting to evade the question, but I'm going to ask again.
It's good to see you're just as hard on everyone.
I want to clarify, because there have been two different stories told about exactly what happened. One story is you were sacked. The other story is your time was up, and that in fact the governor had the option of reappointing you, but in fact you would have cycled off if things had just been, in the normal course of things. Was your term on the commission up at the moment that the governor declined to reappoint you?
Yes, my term had expired September 1st, and the phone call I got was September 29th.
So it's entirely possible that the governor just chose not to reappoint you.
That's entirely possible.
It is, okay. Governor White, you have been in the position that the governor was in at the time. Did you like his answer? Is that possible? Okay. You served as governor. You understand the pressures on a governor in situations like this. And as we pointed out, you were responsible for carrying out the executions in your administration of 19 men. Talk about how you view Governor Perry's conduct and the portrayal of Governor Perry in this film, fair or unfair.
I think it's fair if you look at it in this perspective that I've been the last governor to have been a lawyer since John Connally. And I think that what is missing here is that non-lawyer governors do not understand how fragile this system is. You saw a defense counsel here who may have been the best one in Carson County. He may have been the best one you could have had. I don't know. But from the attitudes that I could sense from what he said, he didn't seem to be pulling for his client quite the way I did when I was defending.
Well, this is after the fact, of course, right?
It doesn't matter whether you're after the fact or not. In his defense, let me say that apparently this science of arson was fairly well settled at the time. If you don't wait a little while later here, but prior to the execution of this Mr. Willingham, the sides changed. The issue that I thought that Barry Scheck brought up so effectively was, what obligation do we have from those people who know the science has changed? We've decided that you do not determine guilt by whether they float or not.
Or, I guess the science on that has changed also, hasn't it?
I'm not sure in every county in Texas that's true.
Well, you're definitely not running, that's for sure.
Well, you don't know.
Don't go north if you go home tonight.
No, but the pressure on the governor is one in which the way I coped with it was that I hired a lawyer named Leslie Benitez, who was an accomplished appellate lawyer, and I think is one of the finest lawyers I've ever met, and I had her go through these complete review on every single execution before it took place by days, sometimes the day of, and would sit down with her and spend literally hours going back and forth asking questions. What kind of lawyer do they have? What was this? What was that?
You took a personal role in all these cases.
I did, just because I didn't want to look up one day and they say, my God, this guy didn't do it. And of course, that still doesn't satisfy the substantial possibility that one of those 19 didn't do it even after the thorough investigation that we made. Therein lies the difficulty with the death penalty. We see our state, and I've always been very proud of our criminal justice system.
And because you've been pro-death penalty.
I've been very pro-death penalty until, and I still am to the extent that I don't believe we ought to execute innocent people. And it's important that we discover the difference and think about the difference between guilt and innocence. Actually, what it is, it's not guilty is not synonymous with innocent. But not guilty is the most incredibly important words in the criminal justice system. Innocence is another concept. Not guilty is the state has failed to prove the case. And that's the whole issue here. Did the state fail to prove the case? Well, they probably proved it by virtue of the science at the time. The science changed and nobody did a thing and let this man be executed.
So you leave open the possibility, Governor, that Mr. Willingham did it, but you don't believe the state proved he did it.
I think it's clear they didn't prove it.
But do you you leave open the possibility?
I don't know anything about whether he did or he didn't.
But the only issue for you is, did the state prove it?
Well, that's the most important issue I can think of.
Right. Mr. Jacobson, do you believe that? Do you share Governor White's view of that?
What's that?
The state did not sufficiently prove its case?
They obviously did, in accordance with what the law was at the time. I mean, there's no question. They went to the U.S. Supreme Court, went to the Court of Criminal Appeals. They obviously did meet their burden in terms of what the jury saw was needful and what the courts measured in terms of what was and what wasn't good evidence. I don't know all the appeals. I haven't read all the briefs. I couldn't tell you whether the Supreme Court looked at the evidence. I think the last appeal was an actual innocence appeal where they had to establish actual innocence to stave off the execution. And with Webb's testimony and his wife's testimony or her statement about him confessing, that seemed to be a pretty high burden. Whether or not that should be the burden, whether or not there should be other procedures, I'm not qualified to talk about that. I'm not a criminal defense lawyer. But the Texas Bar Journal this month, I don't know if you all saw it, but actually has a pretty good series of articles on this very topic. What should the burden of proof be in capital cases? What about forensic science? And let me say this about the Forensic Science Commission. God bless them. I mean, I hope they make evidence as good as it can be in any case in Texas. I mean, the truth needs to be what the truth is and not something else.
You want to say a word, Mr. Bassett, about the commission's work since your departure? You feel comfortable with what you've seen and what you know of how the commission has approached its task?
One comment about what Steve just
said.
I think the key to the Willingham case, if it could be redone, would be the preservation of the physical evidence. That's what we see in all these cases that are getting reversed for DNA. If they had preserved that rubble pile, if they had preserved the crime scene appropriately, if they had done the chemical tests on the flooring, then we might know a lot more.
Well, they did do the chemical tests on the flooring. They didn't find any arson and any traces in the house.
The scrapings in the pile that they talked about that nobody looked at, as Dr. Hurst said, that's where the key to the case were.
And this is a great example of people filling in gaps where there is a story to be told on the floor. If you ask James Palos what he did, he went over it.
Tell us who he is, please.
He's the fire marshal in Corsicana. Lynn Robitaille, who's the current general counsel of the Forensic Science Commission, and Lee Tomlin, who was the assistant to the, I guess, the executive director, was Bradley.
Kind of the administrator of the
essentially,
commission.
Essentially, yes. Came to Corsicana, sat down, talked to our fire marshal, talked to James Palos, and they just asked him the question, what did you do at the crime scene? And he explained, we got down there with little, almost like forks and spoons and little toothbrushes and went through, and they checked everything that was there, and then they got up and shoveled that out the window, and then they went to another section of the floor and did, I think, what it is they're supposed to do. They didn't just shovel the contents of the room out the door. They looked at it. Nobody ever asked them under oath in the trial transcript if they looked at it, but they looked at it.
Governor, you had a point you wanted
well,
to make.
Well, that's almost beside the point. The point is, not whether they looked at it, if they looked at everything as thoroughly as any human being could, they still were applying a phony standard to what arson is. And you can't get around it. They didn't know what the standard, this was false science. Everybody agrees it was false. What is just unbelievable is that the fire marshal's office, in the face of what they know today to be the better science, still says the old false science was applied okay. That's just mindless.
And they're using the new science, not the old science, under current investigations, correct?
Yeah, and yep, but the letter you saw on the screen, they're still standing behind their prior decision right. That this was arson on what is commonly acknowledged today as being false science. That's just a bureaucratic mindset that is beyond belief. That's why you have elected officials that hopefully will stand up and say, pal, don't do that.
Mr. Bassett, come back to the commission before I ask some questions of our filmmakers here. How do you think the commission has done under Mr. Bradley and since your time on the commission ended?
Well, I was always worried from the very beginning that the investigation would be delayed and extinguished. And luckily, the scientists on the commission had kind of rose up and said, we're not going to sit by and just ramrod this thing to a quick conclusion based on primarily reports that Mr. Bradley drafted. And so I was very heartened by the scientists on the commission taking control and stepping up and saying, you know, we're gonna do our job and we're gonna finish our job and we're gonna look at the science and we're not gonna short circuit this thing.
How'd you get appointed in the first place?
The statute provides that the Texas Criminal Defense Lawyers Association can submit 10 names to the governor's office from which he selects one. At the time, there wasn't much interest in the commission. I think there were four or five names submitted, and he chose my name out of the four or five that were submitted. The Prosecutors Association...
I thought you were going to say chose my name out of a hat. You didn't have a relationship with the governor before this?
No, I did not.
What do you know about Dr. Pirwani, who has now been appointed to replace Mr. Bradley, since Mr. Bradley's renomination as presiding officer was not confirmed?
I have heard good things about Pirwani from both defense attorneys and prosecutors, and the comments that I've seen him make during meetings indicate that he's a man of integrity, and I'm looking forward to his leadership.
Let me ask the two of you guys about a couple things in this film, and I want to ask Mr. Jacobson afterwards about these same things, because they are two moments in the film that really struck me. First of all, Willingham's defense attorney. I keep wanting to put air quotes around that, defense attorney, because he maybe makes the strongest case against his client of anybody in the film, actually. He seemed quite willing, with his chickens clucking in the background or whatever it was, to have you up there and talk to you for as long as possible, and he ends up being a major, significant character in this movie. Yep. Talk a bit about him, please.
Well, we were very lucky to get him. Joe finally contacted him on the phone, and we went up, and let me say, Alice, his wife, did the interview, which is very helpful.
Alice, Joe's wife, did
Alice, yeah, Joe's wife. Right. And he gave us a lot of time, and he specified where it would be. It was outside in the summer in a pole barn. But he was very forthright, and we really liked him. He was a charming guy, but we were surprised as it went on. It was one of the nice things about a documentary where we just let people talk. And the longer he talked, the more bizarre it got. In a way that you could never predict. And then in terms of editorial, we had to have someone make the case for the prosecution. And he was the best person we got.
Now, we have four lawyers up on this stage. You and I are not lawyers, thankfully, but we have four lawyers up on this stage. Is there a point at which you walk right up to the line of violating your professional standards? I mean, he didn't violate the attorney-client privilege. Maybe after his client's death, there's no such protection for the client's...
No, there is.
...protected statement. What Willingham told him is protected. Anybody else get the impression that he kind of walked up to the line, maybe waved at it and started to take a step over it?
I didn't really get the sense that he was committing ethical violations by his comments. I'm always very careful after I try a tough case because I'm very sensitive to my client's family and the possibility that things might have happened that weren't correct, and I certainly don't take the approach he takes about talking about his former client. That's what I
said. You just say you wouldn't handle it that way?
No.
Gov?
I was appointed to defend one individual on a death penalty case when I was a fairly fresh lawyer, and had another senior lawyer appointed to make sure that we didn't just go out and help execute our own client. But I think he got off primarily because he was young and not because he had such great lawyers. But I think what it does point out, this lawyer that you interviewed, is how many times has he tried a death penalty case?
Don't know the answer to that, but he's a very capable trial lawyer.
There's no question he's a capable, smart person. But I can assure you that there is a huge difference between someone who's experienced in prosecuting, as you were talking about one of the members of your panel from the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office. You have a prosecutor in urban areas where they try death penalty cases frequently. In rural Texas, you will very rarely find death penalty qualified lawyers to defend someone over there, particularly if they're appointed counsel, and this one I think was.
He was. His co-counsel, Rob Dunn, has tried 20 or 30 death penalty cases. And he was there to provide that seasoned, familiar assistance to David. Rob is probably, he's retired now, but that's why he was appointed. And probably every capital case that's been tried in Nevada County in the last 20 years, he's been a co-counsel. Well, we had a few, I don't know, 10, 15 probably.
I'm just curious, why would the most experienced defense counsel be the second chair in a case?
Because I think David, he's more aggressive. He wants to win real bad. I think he and Rob actually worked out between themselves who did what. I think that the David had just moved back to Corsicana. He wanted to win better than anybody. He wanted to win that case.
Yeah, I was going to add, reading the transcript, I mean, he actually did do a very good job in the case. I mean, I think that he did an excellent job. The problem was is that he didn't have an expert testimony, and all he could do is cross-examine.
You know, you raised that, Joe. I was in the courtroom the day that he went up there to get approval from the judge to hire an expert. And he was, I'm going to win this case. He didn't do it. Judge is going to get me some money so I can go hire me an expert. Great, David. Good luck to you. 3 months later, I see him in the same courtroom. He just is despondent. He couldn't find an expert to support the theory of the case. Now, whether we talk to the Lentinis of the world or the Vasquezes, I don't know the answer to that. David could tell you that perhaps. But he was doing the best he could do to defend his client.
Well, here again, I think that points out, once again, when there's a complete sea change in the science, something should happen. You shouldn't have to wait. The courts are not set up to handle that. Everything's been closed. The case is over. We've tried it. He's been found guilty. They've appealed it. He's been affirmed. His conviction's been affirmed. And now there's been a sea change in the foundation of the whole case, and the courts are not well-equipped to deal with that.
Yeah,
that's what a governor can do to some limited degree. That's what we see this situation occur over in our Court of Criminal Appeals the other day, closed the court. Judge should have been saying ab initio that we're going to stay this case because the Supreme Court of the United States has just stayed a case identical to the same facts.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that the judiciary isn't equipped because you were talking before the film about the legislature, the past session, and the argument was made in the legislature that it's the judiciary's responsibility to deal with these sorts of problems. And if all of us are lawyers, we know that separation of powers is such that criminal justice policy is the job of the legislature. But that's not, I guess, common knowledge in the legislature that it's their job to decide criminal justice policy. But anyway, what I was getting at is, you know, there are elements in the judiciary that are trying to fix this and that are bringing the forces together. Judge Barbara Hervey has done an excellent job with the Forensic Science Task Force, bringing prosecutors and judges and defense attorneys together to talk about these things.
Having talked to the state fire marshal's office briefly about this, I think part of the problem is they don't have any centralized way to analyze cases that have been tried in various parts of Texas, not just criminal cases, but civil cases too. Because for Corsicana, we don't have the resources there to have an electrical engineer, for example, on staff to come in and do modeling of arc mapping in a case where there might be a short that causes a fire. We simply don't have that kind of resource. It has to start with the state fire marshal's office, but they've got people all over the state, 254 counties, 400 and what, some odd district courts. I think part of the problem, if it's going to get solved, the legislature will have to solve it. They'll have to set aside funds, they'll have to create a database, they're going to have to put somebody in charge of analyzing the data to figure out when a new scientific development does or does not impact an existing case. You'll have to keep track of every appeal, somewhere in the courts of the state of Texas, every appeal that's already over with, and I think, again, civil as well as criminal, because I'm sure fire science in civil cases can be very important as well, millions of dollars at stake. I think it has to be a legislative answer. I don't think there's any other way to do it.
Well, Governor, and then I want to ask one last question to Mr. Bassett before we open it up for the audience.
One of the things that concerns me is the state bar hasn't taken the lead on this. They understand the frailties of this condition, and they understand the difficulties the courts have of looking back at a case that's been procedurally concluded. And the state bar needs to be more active in taking a role on this. The legislature is not terribly well equipped to do it. The state bar ought to be out here in front saying, my God, what happened in Houston with that whole mess they had down at their forensic, their crime lab. Look what happened in Dallas. Dallas, in their enthusiasm to have convictions, they put a lot of innocent people into the joint. Their over-eagerness, the thing that you see happening down in Fort Bend County where they had a dog out there sniffing different cups to determine the guilt of the person that they were charging with a crime. How do you cross-examine the dog? I mean, this is just mind. I mean, there needs to be a complete review of this system from a forensics point of view that's much broader than I think that they've even undertaken. And the state bar is better equipped to do or provide leadership on this, I think, than maybe any other organization.
And that was really where I was going to go with Mr. Bassett. You know, you're in a unique position now, having been on the inside, now being on the outside. What do you think ought to happen in this case? Is there anything that can happen in this case going forward, or should we just leave the matter alone?
Well, the first important thing has happened. The commission wrote a report generally describing the changes in the science, what's happened over the course of the last 20 years, and what should be done to enhance the science, promulgate the science, and make sure that everybody in the state is aware that arson science is now more of a science than an art. And if you have one of these cases, you need to be aware of that. The second thing that needs to happen is they need to conclude the investigation. And I'm frankly tired of waiting. This complaint was filed in 2006. And I'm frankly offended that in 2011 we still don't have a final report. And so they need to finish the investigation. But what's happening that is good out of this, I think, is there's more attention to forensic science. And I'm a member of an organization of lawyers who we have between 4 and 8 forensic training for lawyer seminars every year now. And part of that is a function of the funding we received when George W. Bush was elected president, and all the stories about the sleeping lawyer and death penalty cases came out, and Texas was a little bit embarrassed. So they had to put some money out to train defense lawyers to defend these cases. It's not perfect, but it's improving.
We've got about 10 minutes, Tanya, how about that, for questions from the audience. And we only have 6 mics. This may not be the result of budget cuts, but we only have 6 mics. So you could just ask your questions loud, and I'll repeat them. And then you can address them either to individual members of the panel, or you can address them to the whole panel. We'd be happy to have you raise your hand and ask any questions. In the very far back there. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Yes.
Governor White, why do you believe in the death penalty?
Governor White, why do you believe in the death penalty is the question. Very simple question.
I think it's an appropriate punishment for horrible crimes.
Use a mic, sir.
I think it's an appropriate punishment for very horrible crimes. And it's something that should be used very limited. It's something rare. It should be something that is without question as to guilt, and that the punishment has been meted out by the jury based upon a fair presentation of all the evidence. I don't believe that we're able to do that with the certainty that I would like to see in the system, and for that reason, we need to be, we're seeing fewer indictments that are capital indictments, we're seeing fewer prosecutions, and I think the people in the state are coming to recognize that it shouldn't be something that's dealt with frivolously. It's not a, I don't believe it's ever been a deterrent to crime. Very few deterrents to crime. If they commit the crime, they never expect they're going to get caught.
Mr. Giles in the back.
Yeah, I may have fallen asleep, but I didn't see any kind of conclusion to the Judge Baer scenario. Is that concluded in anything?
Question is, what has happened with the resolution of the Judge Baer Court of Inquiry?
Sure, yeah, and we're working on a coda to the film because obviously we're not going to be able to do Q&A after every screening. So when it starts at the Violet Crown in September, we will have an addendum to the film to answer this. But basically, Judge Baird retired from the bench in December of last year. And during that Court of Inquiry proceeding, the Navarro County District Attorney actually...
Lowell Thompson, right, yeah.
Lowell Thompson filed a writ of mandamus, and there was a stay of the proceedings. And so it's within the power of his successor to resume the Court of Inquiry, but Judge Baird was not allowed to continue the Court of Inquiry.
Was there not an allegation that somehow Judge Baird had a conflict given the role that he had played previously in this case?
Yeah, Lowell Thompson, the DA, filed a motion to recuse Judge Baird, contesting his impartiality. And the way that the Texas recusal rules work is he's has to grant the motion and recuse himself or refer the motion to the administrative judge who appoints an independent judge to rule on the merits of the motion, and he did neither. So Lowell Thompson went to the Third Court of Appeals and basically got a stay until that issue could get resolved. And as Joe pointed out, the Mr. Judge Baird's term expired before the appeal ran its course, and it just became a moot issue.
So it's in limbo right now.
I think it's over with. I think it's a moot point. He doesn't need to recuse himself. He's retired now. Whether or not the sitting judge in that court, to whichever court it might be assigned, wishes to take up that mantle, that's a decision for that judge, whoever he or she may be.
And before that motion, there was a motion made that Willingham's relatives did not have the standing to bring the case because his mother, who raised him from 2 months, wasn't a blood relative. So she did not have standing in his cousin. But that was not sustained by the judge, and so they made that motion.
That's probably true, though. She doesn't have standing under Texas law. A survival action, that she can't bring it.
Wait.
I'll talk to you about that.
Ma'am.
I have a question for the filmmakers. Were there people that you really wanted to have in this film that you agreed to be in the film?
Anybody who you wanted to interview in the film, but you could not get them to sit for an interview with you?
Of course.
John Bradley.
Yeah, no, we did. Everyone who we would like, we did approach, and repeatedly.
You approached Chairman Bradley about being interviewed. He declined.
Yeah, from the very beginning.
You approached the governor about being interviewed, I know, as well.
Yes.
And he declined.
It was during the campaign, though, and he wasn't conducting interviews or debates. The only interview he did was with Evan.
Thank you, Evan.
My 15 seconds of fame, sir. That's a question you all heard. This is related to the statement of the mother of the children, Willingham's wife at the time. And in fact, her statement, I don't believe she had made that statement publicly about his confessing to her before this press conference. Is that right? Had she said that before?
My understanding is, where I've seen it before, is in the appellate record. After she came back from Huntsville or wherever Todd was incarcerated, she called a family meeting and told her family what Todd had said to her during this meeting some 2 weeks or so before his execution. A brother, Ronnie Kirkendall, gave an affidavit, it's in the appellate record, that describes what he said, she said.
But she herself never came out publicly until that moment.
Correct. Other than that, I'm completely unaware of whether she ever publicly said anything.
So talk for the questioners to the questioners a question here about how you handled that inclusion in the film. And
well, it was fascinating. I mean, objectively, timing-wise, that happened about 2 weeks before the general election. And so she was brought out. And as you see in the film, we put all that in there where Johnny Sutton says she's going to read a statement, and I'll answer the questions. And so we tried to put all that in there because it seems very strange that a person who had refused to go public would go public in such a way at that time, but then not allow a follow-up question to get to what all the her story raises as many questions as it answers, and people were not allowed to.
Has she spoken or given an interview of any sort since the? And you say she lives in.
She lives in Corsicana. I think she's remarried. At the time of the fire, she was working in a bar. Now I think she works as an assistant in at the hospital. If I saw her any time prior to seeing her on the film with Johnny Sutton, I wouldn't know if I did or not. She keeps a very low profile in Corsicana. I'm certain that everybody who has written on this, all the newspapers, all the television people, Anderson Cooper, back when the story first broke, I was getting phone calls. Can you get me in to see Stacy? Is there a way somebody you can call that can talk to Stacy? And I don't know Stacy. To my knowledge, she has never spoken about the subject except for what she said.
Not before and not since.
Correct.
Yeah. And the timing of this, it was literally going on at exactly the moment that the court of inquiry proceeding was happening.
The question I wanted to always ask is, Stacy, how did you find Johnny Sutton?
Yeah. He's a good lawyer.
You have a theory there you want to offer, Mr. Former Chairman?
Just curious how somebody from Corsicana calls Johnny Sutton in Austin and says, please represent me.
He's a great shortstop, too.
He was a very good baseball player, that's true. Are you alleging that there's politics involved in her ending up with Johnny Sutton?
I think that's entirely possible.
You are a crafty individual, I will say that. Other questions? Let me take Commissioner Sonleitner and then over here. Yes. He's passed away by now, has he not?
Yes. I think he passed away in 2000, maybe, 2001. He passed away before the controversy ever surfaced.
But Mr. Fogg, who was referred to in the film, was the deputy investigator, is that right?
He was the assistant fire chief.
He is still with us, and much to my shame,
being from Corsicana, he gave an interview to somebody. And he's dressed in shorts and black shoes and black socks. He looks pretty. I hate that people would think of Corsicana and look at Doug Fogg in this picture. I don't recall who the interview was.
I'm glad you said it, actually, and none of the rest of us did.
Well, if you saw David Martin and Anderson Cooper, did you see him? David Martin also gave Anderson Cooper an interview as well when all this was going on. And he was sitting there, and I guess the light was in his eyes, and his glasses were reflecting the light, and he had his old cowboy hat on. And, excuse me for being late, I've been out working cows, and just kind of sits in there and starts answering questions. And we were laughing uncontrollably because we were thinking that people the world over, when they think of Corsicana, Texas, they think of David Martin and how he looks in that particular scene. I got a text from a friend of mine who's an anesthesiologist, and he said, there are liberals all over the world tonight thanking God they don't live in Navarre County, Texas.
Wait. Ma'am. Questioner says it appears that what has happened to fire science is now happening to shaken baby syndrome. Does anybody up here have a comment about that?
Yeah, you know, you see it all over across disciplines where they're reevaluating all this testimony that's been presented as expert testimony for years. One of our colleagues, actually, that was playing with us at the AFI Discovery Silver Docs in Washington a couple weeks ago made a film about that, or not about a case involving that, I believe, called Scenes of a Crime. I'm sorry, I got confused. That's actually about false confessions, which is another very fertile area of research where people are discovering that contrary to what common sense would tell you, that people of certain intelligence levels will confess to a crime that they did not commit after a certain amount of interrogation.
We take one more, and then we're going to let you out into the night, sir.
I have a question to the governor on the 19 executions that you were part of. I mean, you mentioned a little bit earlier
Let me ask, do you have any firsthand? The question is, what's the process that Governor Perry undertakes to examine these cases? Do you have any personal knowledge of how the governor approaches
this? I don't know how he handles it. I talked to then-Governor Bush on a couple of death penalty cases, and I think that they rely very heavily, as they should, on the lawyers on their staff. But then again, those lawyers generally don't have any criminal law experience. And I think that there's a, you know, the main thing the governor can do is grant a 30-day stay, which is pretty important, as you pointed out in the film. If there's going to be an execution tomorrow, 30-day stay looks like a real good deal. And so one of the problems I think that we have is that governors don't have experienced counsel, criminal counsel, handy for them to refer to as to whether this person has some legitimate complaint or some reason for them to grant the stay. I think, you know, the tendency would be grant the stay. It's 30 days, you've been on death row for 11 years, 13 years, whatever it is, 20 years. What's another 30 days? State doesn't suffer. If the guy's, you know, that way the governor can always say, I did what I could.
Yeah, I think the Houston Chronicle actually has sued the governor's office about that, trying to get memos that were produced in advising him about the execution, and they haven't yet been able to resolve that suit.
Let me say a word or two in closing. This film premiered at South by Southwest. It then played, as Joe alluded to, at the AFI Discovery Channel Silver Dogs Film Festival in Washington, D.C. in June, and it opens in September, I believe on September 16th,
that's right,
at the Violet Crown Theater downtown. Please tell your friends if you like the film, if you like these filmmakers and you want to support this film, theatrically is a pretty good thing to be talking out about in the world. Mr. Jacobson drove down today from Corsicana. He will turn around and drive back to Corsicana tonight. Governor White drove here from Houston. Are you turning around driving back to Houston tonight? He is turning around driving to Houston tonight. Let's give special hand to those two for their generosity in participating. And then finally, a hand for the panel. We are very fortunate to have these fine individuals here with us tonight and to give some of their time to this event. We thank the filmmakers especially for letting us show it. We thank all of you for supporting the Tribune. We thank Sam Bassett and Mark White and Terry Jacobson for being here. Thank you all very much. Look forward to seeing you again.